Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
To Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information on this, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. First segment of our show, we'll hear from Christina Morton, be sharing a little bit of her family's story of disability life. So tell me a little bit about your story.
Yeah, so I'm Christina Morton, and I had a set of twin boys, fraternal, in 2008, and they are now 12 years old. And then I had another set of twin boys that are identical in 2009, and they are now 10 years old. So they're 21 months apart. And I remember when I was pregnant the second time, I thought, oh, this will be smooth and easy, only one kid to carry. This is going to be pretty simple. And then I found out I was carrying identical twins. So that makes it for a little more different experience, even from the twins, and different special doctors that came into play to make sure we had a successful pregnancy and delivery. Everything was great with delivery. The 10-year-old twins, Seth and Liam, were born at about 6 pounds apiece. Life just seemed normal until about 9 months later when I took them to their daycare for the first time. And when I went to pick them up at the end of the day, she said, you know, something just feels different. She goes, I can't really pinpoint it, but when I picked them up, compared to other children who are about the same age, it's just different. All that is the ragdoll effect. You pick up a doll and it just kind of hangs there. And I didn't realize that was happening because they're identical twins and they both felt the same to me. So when you pick them up, they didn't really clutch on to you. They didn't put their arms or legs around you. And so then started a lot of the doctor's appointments and lab testing to figure out what was going on with them. At about 18 months old, they were officially diagnosed with Emery-Dreifuss muscular dystrophy. And so, of course, a lot of questions, a lot of no answers. That type of muscular dystrophy is very unstructured. Onset can be anywhere from birth, which was theirs, until any other point in life. And the symptoms can be different for everybody.
How did you react to their diagnosis?
Well, I guess knowing at 9 months that something was different, you start kind of looking around. We could only take one test at a time to see what it might be, and then you wait 6 or 8 weeks to get results, so you start looking. And when it came to the 18 months, it was multiple emotions happening. One, thankful, okay, we know what this is. We know what we can or can't do. We know what direction we need to head at this moment in time for physical therapy or different things like that. And then I guess for me as the mom and having 2-year-old boys also, you don't really have time to sit and think about the negatives of what might it happen or be. You just kind of got to trug forward and live life. And I guess that's been my biggest thing I've tried to teach my children and my family is we just keep moving on with life. And don't get me wrong, there are many days where you sit back and you might have the tears or you might have the what ifs. But at that moment in time, it was, okay, what do we do next? Who's going to the consult down at the doctor's? What can we learn? What do we do? What do we need? And you just kind of keep moving forward. And then those other emotions hit later in time when you're sitting there alone, maybe at night, and you're thinking about those what ifs. But what I've always taught them is try and put a smile on your face and you walk out that door every day and do what you need to do in the world.
So in those moments, when you do have what ifs, what gets you through it? What are the most effective coping mechanisms you use?
I guess for me, what I use is let it happen. Let those what ifs happen. Let those thoughts happen. Let those tears come out and then pick it up and move on. And in within there, at some point, you're going to start looking at the things that you do have. When they were diagnosed at 18 months, they were walking. And I want to say they walked pretty good till first, second grade, maybe third grade or so. It was pretty much no walking, just some steps here and there. And one of the hardest parts when I went to that first consultation at the hospital was hearing and reading when I first looked it up is there's nothing you can do. You can't change this. I can't slow it down. I can make some of the symptoms happen later. But they're going to happen in the case such as elbow contractures and things like that. I can do stretching, and that contracture might happen 6 months or a year down the road, but it's going to happen. That's the progression of the disease, of the muscle wasting. So physical therapy, and it was really hard when we worked with the schools and their definitions of their goals. The goal is never to gain strength. The goal is never to walk farther. The goal is to be comfortable. The goal is to adapt where needed. If you can get up from the floor in a tripod a year ago, that might not be the case today. So if you're on the floor, how do you get up? How do you adapt to different ways of getting into the shower or the bath? How do you adapt when you were walking with a reverse walker to now you're in a scooter to now a power chair to now a wheelchair? How do you manage those in different environments? So as far as physical therapy goes, sometimes it's a means to make yourself get out of the house. Sometimes it's a means to maybe you're getting a swimming adventure out of it and working in the pool. So it takes on different roles than physical therapy for someone after an injury or someone after a hip replacement. You know, you're going to get back to your normal mode of life. And it's different when you're taking physical therapy to learn to adapt for life changes.
So if you could send any message to the community about this condition.
There's a lot, I guess, that you want the community to know. My children, Seth and Liam and Andrew and Carson, they go to Bishop Arrigan Catholic School in Sheboygan, Michigan. And that community has been amazing. I've gone in a couple times and talked about Emery-Dreifuss muscular dystrophy. I've gone in and talked about discrimination against people with disabilities. And one thing I brought to them in a fifth, sixth, and seventh grade classroom to try to help explain it is a lot of times you're just going to hear the term so-and-so has or someone has or a friend or family has muscular dystrophy. So then in terms of the specific type, and this type is called Emery-Dreifuss muscular dystrophy, it's rare, it's unstructured, which means that I'm in a community, a Facebook community with a lot of other members that have it. And there's adults, 60, 70 years old, that walk, that function what we would say normal with jobs. And don't get me wrong, they have concerns, issues, and symptoms. And then I might see a 2-year-old or a 4-year-old, or in the case of my 10-year-old, already in a wheelchair, already unable to walk. So it affects everyone differently. It's a full body is what my children have. So arms, shoulders, legs, heart, lungs are different things we have to watch all the time. So as a community, maybe one of the great things is ask questions. You know, I'll see a lot of parents or adults look at my children and maybe say to them, oh, stop looking. No, tell them to come over and ask their name. Treat them like they might treat anyone else not sitting in a chair. Just come over and say, hey, what's your name? And it's also okay to say, why are you in a chair? Or why can't you walk? Or what's wrong with your legs? I would rather you do that than when I see adults look at my kids who are riding in what we call a scooter or it might look like an Amigo to some people. And I'll hear them say, oh, they're going to hit something or they're going to fall off. Yeah, they probably are. They're still 10-year-old kids. But what this other adult might not realize is that's their only means of transportation. That's their only means to get around the store. Normally, I live in a small community. Everyone is amazing. A lot of people know my children. They even were on the football team, call it, 1 year. So even though they go to the Catholic school, we were able to get to know a lot of the other kids from the other schools. But we had a case. We were in a store, and they were riding. I didn't have our amigos that day. They were riding one of the store's associate, hollered across several aisles for people to hear, yelling at them to get off and quit goofing around. And they weren't. So it's just awareness. You can't always think the worst. Yes, I get there's probably cases where that does happen, but maybe just come over and ask questions and see what's going on. As a community, one of the best things that happened without me asking, without me even knowing that this was even really an issue, because we learned just to accept, but at our Little League fields, I got a message one day that had asked me if I could stop by with the boys one time and check out the new threshold for the building going into the restroom. Someone had noticed either we were carrying the boys in or they were trying to get their scooters over the threshold and there was a little bit of a step there and it was difficult. They just put a little board in place and it made it easy for the boys to get over the threshold and access the bathrooms. And that little bit of attention to detail, I mean, I sat with happy tears in my eyes that day, just like, how amazing is that, that I didn't even know there was an issue and someone was making it better for my kids. So the awareness, if you're not sure, and in a case like you did here, invite us. Invite us to share our story. Invite us to the school, to an assembly, to explain to other kids. Invite us to share. And don't walk past us and turn your head. Just say hi.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
No problem.
In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Duraine Wong Rieger from CORD. So tell me a little bit about the organization.
So the Canadian Organization for Rare Disorders is a national alliance mostly made up of rare disease organizations, about 100 plus organizations that serve patients that have, you know, rare and ultra rare diseases. We also have individual members, but we really try to work through the patient organization to work closer to their members on the ground there.
So
we do advocacy work, we do policy work, we do a lot of work towards trying to do education and awareness around rare diseases, writ large, but also specific disorders as well.
So when it comes to the education aspect, do you find there are a lot of myths or misperceptions out there concerning rare disorders?
The problem with the word rare disorders, of course, is it covers a whole range of diseases, and some diseases which people, when you tell them about it, are really surprised to know that they are rare diseases. You know, include things like muscular dystrophy, cystic fibrosis, hemophilia. There are diseases that, when you think about, you know, sort of the grand number of people that are affected, actually do affect few people, may become very well known to them. Some of them are life-threatening diseases. Some of them are debilitating diseases. Some of them are lifelong diseases. About 70% will affect children. And the sad news is that about 30% of those children will not live beyond the age of 5. So there's a huge range of diseases, but for the most part, we recognize them as being severe, lifelong, debilitating diseases.
So how do you go about reaching out to potential partner organizations and coordinating the effort?
Well, because we are an umbrella network, we have been around in terms of raising awareness around rare diseases. We host events at least twice a year. We do webinars. We also get contacted by the disease groups themselves. If they've got an issue, they want some support in terms of advocacy, they will reach out to us, as a matter of fact, in order to participate. So it really is a cumulative effort in terms of being out there, being, you know, visible, but also responding to the needs. Sometimes their families, sometimes their, you know, patient organizations, in terms of helping them address their own needs in terms of support, education, access to medicines, advocacy for, you know, inclusion in different policies, including things like disabilities, education, work policies.
So what are some of the biggest challenges in terms of policy?
The biggest challenge with regard to policy for rare disease is that they get lost. You know, we have big policies around cancer, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, into even mental health. But because rare diseases, each disease affects only a small number of patients, they kind of get lost in terms of the policy work. And it's only been in the last number of years that we've really been able to have this kind of a coordinated, integrated effort. So even though we say each rare disease only affects a few people, there are really somewhere between 6,000 and 7,000 rare diseases in the world, and taken together, in Canada at least, they affect almost 3 million people. So they are large in number, but because each disease individually affects so few people, and because they are varied, and because they have different kinds of needs or different kinds of impacts, sometimes it's hard to get policymakers to actually focus on those rare diseases or even include the rare diseases when they're doing policies. I mean, an example would be disability. So there are policies for disabilities, but to qualify for some of these disability programs, they have to be included and listed in terms of these are the conditions that qualify. And if you're a rare disease, you may never get listed. So they get missed a lot. And even in terms of diagnosis, to get a proper diagnosis might actually take a long time. So policies around newborn screening, for instance, it's very easy to kind of miss what, you would need to do to diagnose a patient with a rare condition.
So when you say misdiagnosis, is there a possibility that some of these rare conditions are actually being passed off as something similar or related, and people aren't even aware that they have something a little more rare?
Yeah, no, that's the absolutely right question. On average, and we did some research a while back there, but it also fits with the international profile, on average it takes 5 to 7 years for a patient for a rare disease to get diagnosed, and oftentimes the symptoms are either dismissed or they are misdiagnosed as something else. Many of our patients will get anywhere from 2 up to 14 wrong diagnoses before they get to the right diagnosis. And sometimes they're treated for the wrong diagnosis for a long time. And sometimes that treatment actually will make their rare disease worse, or they will not get the right treatment that, if it had been brought in at the right time, could have actually prevented the more debilitating effects of the disease. So it is the case. It's getting better now because a lot of these diagnoses, about 70 to 80% are genetic conditions, so that if you do the right genetic testing, you actually could get a diagnosis much quicker. But, even today, a lot of those genetic tests, what we call that next generation genomic sequencing, is not readily available. It's still somewhat costly. So until we get to the point where a family that actually recognizes they have a child with a disease that doesn't fit the kind of diagnosis, an ordinary diagnosis, until we can get them to getting a good genetic genomic testing, it really still will be a challenge for these patients to get the right diagnosis.
So in your time with the organization, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
There are many, many success moments, quite frankly. I mean, one of the things that has happened is that we've seen lots of drugs that are coming into Canada for rare diseases, and we have been able to, bring, 50, 60 of these therapies into Canada for children, patients, families. So that has been a huge, achievement. We've been able to get changes in terms of the way in which these drugs are reviewed so that they actually can be more properly assessed and made available to patients. We have been trying for many years to get a rare disease strategy in Canada, and even though we've proclaimed one and it's functional, it's never been officially recognized in the same way that a cancer strategy might be. But last year, for instance, the federal government actually announced that we will have a rare disease drug strategy to really try to bring, to make rare disease drugs more accessible to patients on an individual basis. Some of these drugs can be very challenging, very expensive. And they announced a startup fund of $1 billion for the first 2 years, beginning in 2022, for us to put this strategy in place. And we are very, very excited about that. Finally, the recognition that rare disease drugs are important and that rare disease drugs do require a separate pathway and a funding process in order to make them available. So, if you talk about a success, I think this is a success that's come after about, 20 years of advocacy, but we're really excited about being able to help develop and to implement that strategy.
So where can people go about finding out more information about the work you do?
They can start with our website, which will also lead them to other links, but the website is just raredisorders.ca.
Right. Thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Canadian Blood Services invites you to save a life today. Every 60 seconds, someone in Canada needs blood. Donating is simple, and your blood will go to help Canadians undergoing heart surgery, leukemia treatment, or those involved in an accident. Go online and book your appointment today at www.blood.ca or give us a call toll-free at 1-888-2-DONATE. That's 1-888-236-6283.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Christina Morton and from Duraine Wong-Rieger.
In this next segment of our show, we'll be chatting with Nayla Farah from CCRW. So tell me a little bit about CCRW.
Okay, CCRW is a national nonprofit organization with the mandate of promoting and supporting equitable and meaningful employment of people with disabilities. We are actually the only national organization with the sole mandate of supporting peoples with disabilities.
So, in your work, what types of conditions do you most commonly see?
Okay, so that's a good question, Cam. We are a cross-disability organization, so all our services and programs are for people with any type of condition or any type of disability, whether it is motor, sensory, related to learning disabilities, environmental sensitivities, you name it.
So, can you give me an overview of some of your programs and services?
Absolutely. So, the programs we offer typically are offered across Canada, and some of them are for geared to job seekers with disabilities who have an academic background or prior work experience. So more professionals with disabilities. An example is the Workplace Essential Skills Program housed in the GTA. And all other programs similar to WESP are open to people with disabilities regardless of their condition, where they stand in terms of having prior careers or not. And some of our programs actually meet the specific needs of youth with disabilities. An example is the youth program that we offer in multiple cities across Canada. It's called Youth the Future. So that is sort of, I would say, most of our programs are in fact programs geared to job seekers with disabilities anywhere in Canada to support them in preparing, tapping, retaining employment. So we work with both the job seekers with disabilities as well as the employers to pave the way for successful employment. A big part of our work consists in supporting employers across the Canada, remove systemic barriers to employment with disabilities, accommodate people with disabilities, leading me to also highlight a renowned CCRW service called the Job Accommodation Service, or JAS for short.
So I'm just wondering, in a mm-hmm. workplace situation where you're supporting a person with a disability, how do you go about clearing up some of the myths and getting around some of the barriers for that person?
Definitely. I mean, there are a variety of barriers that we face, we people with disabilities, some of them being architectural. So the workplace itself not being where not all people are able to access it. Technological, so people who aren't able to use the systems and the technology used in a workplace. And a lot of the barriers consist in attitudinal barriers. So we know that no matter sometimes the level of education you've achieved, no matter how the number of your abilities, we still need to do work with employers to look at the abilities rather than the disability and assist them through training, so through workshops, but oftentimes through handling cases on a case by case. Certainly, helping our clients to advocate for themselves, to how to present themselves in an interview, how to disclose a disability, and also obtaining the tools that will assist them in successful employment. So whatever the job demands are, the job accommodation service will assist the employee with a disability as well as the employer in identifying what are the barriers and how to, if not alleviate them completely, certainly minimize them. So we will look at what are those barriers. Are we talking about an employee, for instance, with a vision disability who's going to be accommodated through a magnification software or perhaps a voice screen reading software. So we are involved on the systemic level, you know, advising employers how to remove systemic barriers, perhaps through having an accessibility audit of their premises or a web accessibility audit of their platforms with instructions as to how to be inclusive and barrier-free at the root, but also getting involved in individualized assessment of the employee in their workplace to identify what are the adaptations, what are the tools that will allow the employee to succeed, as well as the employer to have a most performing employee.
So in your time with CCRW, is there any success story that stands out for you, where you were really able to help someone?
Absolutely. I mean, while we have lots of testimonial from clients we assisted in employment, I will remember a story actually of an employee of a major bank in Canada who had a learning disability. He was very successful in his job with the bank. Then he was promoted to a job whereby he needed to communicate properly in writing, and that was his weakness. His manager was about to let him go, given that his communication in writing was almost not understandable. So he engaged us because human resources in this bank asked him to go through that step to ensure that the employee can be accommodated to boost his performance. So the Jazz at CCRW was engaged in an individual assessment of that employee, and the solution was simply a voice dictation software where he was able not only to retain his job, but also to get the most prominent award of the top performer at that bank, leading him to actually that award consisted in a cruise, in a free cruise for him. So what I want to leave you with is that sometimes simple accommodations can make the largest difference between failure and success.
Right. Thank you for taking time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Absolutely.
This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you, we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.